go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. So, as you can probably tell by the background roar, I'm in a big, noisy room. Yes, it is the 11th day of July, 2019. This program is live, as you, like I said, may have noted, from a big, noisy room. In point of fact, the Pennsylvania Convention Center, right smack dab in the heart of Center City, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As mentioned before, this is my first time in Philly, and I gotta say, it's a lovely town, what I've seen of it so far. This is, of course, Netroots Nation, Radio Row, and it looks like a pretty good crowd so far. Lots of panels, lots of good progressive, liberal intention and activism and determination. And this is just day one. So I thought I would just do a little bit of blather for this first evening. And oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. And, you know, that always turns out to be a bit of a problem. Hi, I'm Bob. Definitely Bob. And so yesterday was a travel day. And today is a set things up and learn the lay of the land day. And then tomorrow evening, if everything works out as planned, we'll do a Friday on the front porch and hopefully have a couple of folks wander by. I'm sharing table space here with Rick Smith of the Rick Smith Show. And our buddy Arnold is here as well. They're off searching for something to eat right now. I did that earlier. We'll probably get the food porn out of the way early on in the program here. And let me thank everybody who made it possible for me to get here and sort of check out what the sense is. I've gone through the exhibit hall and talked to a few people, just, you know, casual conversations. Invited some folks to come by here and chat and carry on a discussion if they're so inclined. There's a lot of progressive causes on exhibit in the exhibit hall. Everything from the judiciary to protecting the right to choose to protecting the rights of immigrants, migrants, and refugees. Labor organizations are here. There are organizations to apparently, hopefully, make online organizing more effective. There are a lot of panels on the technical side of liberal and progressive organizing. All told, there are a lot of rich opportunities here for people to learn, and hopefully, by the time next year's campaigns roll around, be better than they had planned. They thought they could be. Coming in. Then that's kind of the point of all this. Every time I go on the road, there's a story, isn't there? And yesterday was no different. So this is how it works. I had to rent a car to get here. And so 3 weeks ago, I reserved an automobile at a specific level of automobile with the fine folks over at Enterprise in Somersville, West Virginia, told them I wanted a little sedan, you know, didn't need an all-wheel drive or anything, all interstate driving, summer weather, you know, didn't anticipate needing to do any four-wheel drive stuff. And so, yeah, you know, something like a Nissan Altima. So the day before yesterday, they called and said, hey, listen, Bob, the Boy Scouts, we've got to deliver 100 cars because the Boy Scouts are here at the, and this I add parenthetically, tax boondoggle, tax exempt, former mountaintop removal, toxic waste site that a bunch of billionaires threw a bunch of money into to create the Boy Scout camp of the world or whatever. Yeah. Not really available to the people who live around here, but, you know, who are there, not here, there. But, you know, who cares? Hillbillies. So, yesterday they called and said, you know, we can't come and pick you up, but, you know, we're ready for you. And if you'll let, you know, we could pick you up, like, you know, we might be there by noon. I said, don't worry about it. I'm easy to get along with. And so I said, listen, you open at 8, right? Yeah. I said, so we will be over there at 8 or a little after because I need to get on the road. I'm going to be driving all day. Okay, great. So yesterday morning, Agnes and I got up, had our morning, well, she had her morning coffee. I had my morning decaf. And we drove over to Summersville, got there about 8:25. And they said, well, your car's not ready. I said, what car is that? They said, well, we were going to upgrade you to a Chevy Impala. Imagine that. A Chevy Impala's an upgrade. In what universe? They said, we took it for an oil change because we didn't think you were going to be here till 10. I said, why would I have not been here till 10 when I told you I would be here at 8? Oh, well, you can wait, or you can have that ominous music here. Nissan Sentra sitting out there. I said, oh, this is not going to be good. But it was that or not get on the road till noon. And so, you know, presented with the 21st century equivalent of Hobson's Choice. You know, the Hobson's Choice is no choice at all. You can have the horse by the door or no horse at all. And, of course, the horse by the door is half lame. And it, right. So I got a Nissan Sentra. And then drove 8.5 hours, that shouldn't have taken 8.5 hours, from home here to Center City, Philadelphia. And, I got out of that car, and I felt like I had been in a bar fight. Oh, man, those things suck. And, you know, if you were in traffic and you really needed to punch it and do something, it sounded like the most badass weed eater on the planet. That Nissan Sentra. But it got me here. Like I said, I got out, and I think that I had every joint in my body popping, and it sounded like I was popping popcorn. But it turned out, by luck or happenstance or any combination of the, I got a great hotel. Sorry. So, but I'm I was telling as I checked in, I told the desk clerk, I said, well, you know, I've got a list of things I have to do while I'm here. And one of them is visit Mr. Franklin's grave. And she said, that's great. That's just right around the corner. And it literally was. One of the nice things about Philly as compared to, say, New York is that there's lots of historical markers around here. And so lo and behold, the site where my hotel is located was the original site of the first buildings of Mr. Franklin's University of Pennsylvania. Because just as Thomas Jefferson envisioned a college in Virginia, Franklin envisioned a university in Pennsylvania. And that hotel now stands where the first buildings of that university, that experiment in education, were. And around the corner from it is, what is it, Christ Church Cemetery. And they've got, there's iron bars there so you can actually see Franklin's grave, and everybody throws a penny on it, and I reach through and put a penny on it too. You know, he said a penny saved is a penny earned, but maybe we can afford to be profligate with the last resting place of probably the most brilliant man who has ever existed, the most brilliant white European man who's ever existed, in that time. And he still ranks pretty high, even unto this day. So then I went walkabout, and I walked around the old city a little bit. I saw because just down from the cemetery is the first synagogue in the United States, of which Franklin, being the tolerant soul that he was an honorary member. Walked on down, saw the Constitution Center, saw the Independence Park visitor. Independence Hall was there. I walked up, saw that. It was beautiful. There was a half moon hanging in the sky, clear blue skies. Pouring outside now, but that evening was simply exquisite. And one of the neat things is that they have they did an archaeological dig on the president's house. Remember that both Washington and Adams were for a time president of the United States, and when the government was seated here in Philadelphia. And they've excavated it, and they have taken great pains, and I think it's really neat that they have. It's respectful. They've gone to great lengths to try to recreate and breathe life into the people who were servants to, and in some instances slaves of, George Washington. And there are interpretive plaques, and there are even videos that play on flat screens, and they've built an outline shell of where that residence was, and it was just I'd say a good center fielder could probably throw a baseball from Independence Hall and reach that site. But it was gratifying to see that maybe that there are overt efforts to move somewhat away from the great white man theory of history, because none of those great men could have been without significant assistance from a lot of people that history, because of the way it was interpreted and written and understood, was presented to us. One of the more fascinating things, though, is that you can look through glass and see that the foundations of that first executive mansion look like they're about 10 to 12 feet below modern Philadelphia. So a lot of history has built up since those days in the late 1780s and early 1790s. A couple of Quaker meeting houses I walked past. fascinating story. There at Franklin's tomb, you will see that he and his wife Deborah are buried there. And also buried there is a little boy named Francis Franklin, aged 4 years, 1 month, and I forget how many days. And the headstone says something like, beloved by all who knew him. History may not match, but it rhymes. Because at that point in time, medical science had just stumbled on to the idea of vaccination and inoculation. And Benjamin Franklin's wife was not as forward-thinking as Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin wanted the little fella inoculated. And Mrs. Franklin forbade it. And the little guy got sick and died at 4 years, 1 month, and however many days. The son of the most brilliant man of his era in this country died because his wife was an anti-vaxxer. I kid you not. Man, oh man, oh man. It was a sobering moment. But it is hot and muggy here, in a way that it must surely have been in 1776, in 1787. Seeing Independence Hall immediately called to mind the perhaps apocryphal, I would like to think it is not, story of how a woman seeing Benjamin Franklin coming out of the Constitutional Convention asked him, Mr. Franklin, Mr. Franklin, who by then was a very old man, perhaps he carried a cane. Mr. Franklin, what kind of government do we have? And Franklin genially looked at her and said, Madam, a republic, if you can keep it. And so the question presented, whether the people attending this conference know it or not, in this town where those words were uttered, remains the same. Can we keep a republic? Can we maintain what was handed down to us, or have the genius ideas of those deeply flawed men in 1787 finally come to their Waterloo? Have they met their match? Will this country descend into a fascistic nightmare that makes the 2 years and change that we have thus far endured seem a walk in the park? I suppose we'll find out. And I also suppose along the way we will discover what sort of metal this side of our debate is made of. Yes? Yes. So those are some initial thoughts. And more as the program continues. So we're back here at Netroots Nation 2019, downtown Philadelphia. A place that Rick Smith knows far more about than I do. I'm a Philadelphia virgin. I don't even know what that means, but
Philly's a great place.
I'm not. You know what? It is. There, as with I guess any city, there are stereotypes. And so far, what I'm seeing of Philly doesn't live up to them.
No. Nope.
Nobody's thrown a battery at me yet.
Not yet.
Yeah.
But you haven't said anything bad about the Eagles yet.
Or the Phillies.
Or the Flyers. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
This is the
Sixers.
Sports time.
Yeah. And so, obviously, you're here for not quite the same reasons I am. I mean, we're sharing a broadcast position here. You've brought the Rick Smith show here, and I've seen you doing a bunch of interviews. But you were also here to be on a panel earlier today.
Yeah, the Teamsters asked me to come down and sit on a panel that they wanted to have presented. How do you win back the working class? And I was privileged enough to sit on the panel with Bill Press and Leslie Marshall.
Wow, they brought Bill and Leslie in.
Yeah.
So was there? Did y'all reach a consensus?
Bill and Leslie seemed to want to disagree a lot. They didn't target me at all. Because I was right. I mean, at the end of the day, my position is very clear. What has the Democratic Party done for the working class that would warrant the working class to want to come back? You know, in the last 40 years, what has the Democratic Party done for workers that would make them want to come back?
But by the same token, it's not like you can make an argument that the Republican Party has done anything for them.
No, I'm right there with you. But at least what the Republican Party has done and what the conservative money has done is built a big enough infrastructure on talk radio, on TV, on virtually every media platform available to tell the working class that Democrats are bad, government's bad, the welfare queen's killing you, and it's those damn illegals. So they've been told this repeatedly to where now that's their concern.
Right.
And they're wrong.
It's the gay, transgendered, atheist, illegal, everything that they hate, and they managed to weasel it into one nasty soundbite of viciousness. Let me ask you, though. Now, ever since 2016, and I know you heard it as much as I did, and you, it used to be when I would mention it on my program, I always turned the reverb on when I said, economic anxiety. Because it became an almost comical canard for trying to say racism without saying racism. It got to the point where it's, you know, you'd see some white lady screaming in a Kentucky Fried Chicken, and said, well, obviously her economic anxiety is acting up today.
To what extent,
I mean, is there another way of saying it without carrying the connotations of just white grievance?
There has to be. I mean, because I didn't say anything about white working class.
No,
I
you didn't.
I said working class. Blacks are Hispanics. Those are working class people, too. At the end of the day, how do you make working class jobs better? How do you get them wages that will help support a family? How do you make sure that they get health care that they need? Retirement security that is now non-existent? To me, those are the issues. Are there some racist, homophobe, misogynists out there in the working class? Absolutely. And my problem with a lot of people have framed it whenever you talk about economic anxiety is that, well, it's only the racists and the homophobes because they're the easiest to go after. For me, I worry about economics all the time. I worry about, am I going to be able to put food on my kids' table?
Well, you know how we run the horn, so you've got a pretty good idea
Absolutely.
Of my grasp of economic anxiety.
Right. We're in the same boat there. And I look at this, and for me, look, you're going to have the racists, the homophobes, and them, and you set them aside. Forget them. You're never going to reach them. Move on. You move on to the people who, look, they truly have concerns.
And I guess my question there, Rick, is how do you tease them? How do you tease them out of that broader part of grievance? I mean, there's grievance and there's grievance. How do you craft that message? Because I agree with you. You know, there's an old line from the movie Mate One, which I'm pretty sure you're familiar with.
Yep.
Where the organizer says, "Listen, there's only two kinds of people in this world: them that work and them that don't. If you work, I'm with you." So, is there anybody out there that's enunciating a message that you think gets it or gets to it?
Not yet. I like Elizabeth Warren's message. I like Bernie Sanders. I like some of the other, you know, some of the other talk. I like Tim Ryan's talk sometime, although I wish he was better. Not yet. We're still new into this. There's still the beginning of this process. There's still a lot to learn about them. I'm encouraged that Elizabeth Warren, sent a video to the striking bus drivers on Martha's Vineyard to give them support. I'm encouraged that Pete Buttigieg showed up at their strike line. I'm encouraged that the Democrats now see worker issues as universally as a party as something that's important. And maybe not in the same lip service way that Barack Obama did. You know, I told the story today that, twice I shook Barack Obama's hand. And twice he looked me in the eye and told me, we're going to get the Employee Free Choice Act done. And twice I said, I hope you get something better, because they thought Bush would sign that. And they got nothing. What we ended up with was the political Lilly Ledbetter Act, which was horrible. Now, I know you're probably going to take some shots from women because, that's a woman's bill. No, what that said is, if you, after a lifetime of work, you find out you've been cheated, you have the ability to go back and sue. That's what that was.
Right.
I'm saying,
remedy.
No, I'm saying, how about we not let them get cheated for a lifetime?
Yeah.
Pass something better than the Employee Free Choice. Just repeal damn Taft-Hartley and give me the right to organize and to collectively bargain as a matter of course.
Now, see, Rick, when you say something like repeal Taft-Hartley, you're probably deep in the weeds for a lot of people, but you saying that confirms to me something that I have said for years, and that is that you are the preeminent voice of labor in media today, period, bar none, end of sentence, close quotes, shut down the paragraph, dash 30, dash. What does it mean to say repeal Taft-Hartley?
Well, I know. I got to get my head back in the cans because I'm getting a big head here. But thank you. That was very nice of you to say. When they passed Taft-Hartley over Harry S. Truman's veto back in, I think it was 47, the idea was to then give employers some rights. The original National Labor Relations Act does not give a paragraph, a sentence, a word, or even a syllable of rights to the employer, because they understood that the employer has all of the rights. What the NLRA did is gave workers some voice, some ability to sit at the table and not be on the menu. And over the years, what's happened is conservatives, Democrats, and Republicans have whittled away at that original intent of the National Labor Relations Act by putting in these idiotic, we got to have secret ballot elections. You didn't have that in the original NLRA. You signed 51% of the cards. You began bargaining right then and there. Not a month, 2 months of harassment, not a close-tested.
And the company doesn't come back and say, we believe that there's been a change of circumstances.
None of that.
People who are not associated with organized labor may not know how often that's the case. I'm fortunate in that I've been schooled by another great labor warrior in West Virginia.
No, absolutely.
Boss Man Wayne, who has taught me more than I ever dreamed I'd want to know, and I'm glad to know. I'm one of those little history geeks. They've got a statue of Taft in a little park in Washington, D.C., down the hill from the Senate side. And, I'm an asshole. I've spit on that statue.
As you should.
Because
I'd like to do something else.
I know what it means.
Be a pigeon for a day.
Oh, where's my cowbell when I need it? But let me try to relate this to something else, and that is, I noticed, we've got this menu here of all the panels that were going on. I noticed that there was one today that was titled, Is It Time for a General Strike? Now, you and I could probably talk from now to midnight about why it's time for a general strike.
It's been time for a general strike for 30 years.
Yeah. But guess what? Inside Taft-Hartley is the reason that there's never been one. Because you can't have, because unions
secondary are... Secondary boycott, priority strikes, all that stuff.
Wildcats are all verboten under Taft-Hartley. So... Is there any way to build? I mean, you talk inside the labor movement pretty frequently.
But here's the thing, and this is where I think your point on the general strike is important. In Kentucky, in West Virginia,
55 strong.
It was not legal for those those teachers to go out on strike.
Yeah.
They did. In the 30s, when they took over the GM plants, and they took over the auto industry, they had their sit-down strikes. It wasn't legal to do that.
Right.
Workers took to the streets. They dominated things because at some point, you've got to be able to exercise your only power, and that's the power of folding your arms.
Right. The right to withhold one's labor is about the only right that a working person
it's
has.
It's the only right.
And it's largely diminished under the current... But I guess my question or my observation is that I have great respect for what happened in West Virginia. But the downside of that is we just had the Republicans come back in a special session, and how did they respond? Well, they made it even illegaler for the teachers to strike,
right?
Because they're incapable of learning. They can learn only through their buttocks, by being beat on. But what happened during 55 Strong, some labor organizations stood up and said, "Yes, we stand by them." Nobody stopped working. A general strike is everybody stops. A general strike is, and I've talked to people from France who say, "Is that what never happened in France?" Because the teachers go out, the garbage men go out, the bus drivers go out, the plane pilots and the mechanics go out, then the judges and the cops go out, because they don't have this silly notion that there are people whose labor is not their own to withhold.
Right.
So is there, what I was going to ask you a couple of minutes ago, is there anything in the way of a conversation going on in organized labor? Because I think they're going to have to be the people who drive this bus. Are there people knocking on doors in the congressional office building saying it's time to repeal Taft-Hartley?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, Bernie Sanders, while at the Machinists Convention not too long ago, he came out and said he was in support of repealing Taft-Hartley. And look, labor wants that gone. It's too much, too many regulations, too much restriction on the ability to bargain and the ability to organize. And it gives the employers too many rights. The pendulum has swung way back to the side of employers, and that's where they like it. It's the reason they fund so much of what the Republican Party does.
Right. I mean, when it was kind of a bellwether moment when right to work and when prevailing wage died in West Virginia and right to work came in, because we were one of the last states you would have expected that to happen, because we did have this long and militant labor history. But in line with that old argument about people voting against their own interests, and that's a complicated conversation in and of itself, labor organizations either didn't put much effort into controlling their members or educating them, or maybe they just actively worked against them. I mean, it was flabbergasting when the UMWA couldn't quite bring themselves to endorse a Democratic presidential incumbent who was far and away better for them, even as mild and tepid as Obama could be, far and away better than Willard Romney ever would have been.
Right.
So, how do you make that conversation happen among not just the leadership but among the rank and file to try to restore some of that militancy?
That's a good question. I just tweeted out a picture just the other day that 6 years ago this week, I was actually in Fairmont, West Virginia. The mine workers had a big rally there to save their health care.
Right.
And I remember going and talking to them about that very topic, about Obama, about the laws that are in place that are harming them, and their support for different politicians, and it was really an interesting exercise in beating my head against the wall.
I was about to cut in and say futility.
Because here are these men, my age and maybe between our ages, who are broken, walking with walkers, breathing on oxygen, and having their lifeline taken away from them. And yet still, they were not supportive of Obama. And I go, but this is the guy you should be pushing. He's willing probably to sign this.
And so flash forward to the modern day. In the first 2 years of Trump's presidency, far more coal-fired power plants have closed than ever occurred during Obama's presidency. When,
right.
And of course, the bogus, the specious war on coal messaging.
Natural gas is the one that killed coal.
Yeah, natural gas was the war on coal, but it was not, well, that didn't have
or
any
frack
use.
Gas.
Yeah, frack gas, no kidding. Let me change to just change tactic or direction just a little bit. What can you say about the nexus, or if there is one, between labor and the environment? Because you and I sitting here together are probably two people who have devoted more time to environmental issues and labor issues than any other broadcasters out there. What is the way forward vis-a-vis organized labor into a green, sustainable, renewable future?
Well, let me start by saying there are some unions that are really good, some that are really bad, and the majority that are silent. They don't know where they're going. At the end of the day, when you have someone like Hillary Clinton say, almost gleeful that the coal miners were going to lose their jobs, that's not helpful. When I have liberals tell me that, well, you know, screw all those union members, all those jobs are going to be gone. I'm sorry, that's not a doable solution. What you need to have is a transition on how you're going to get from point A to point B that includes those unions.
Right, and in the environmental community, we refer to that in terms of being a just transition.
Right. Now, the Blue-Green Alliance has been doing this for years. The Green New Deal didn't come out of AOC's behind. She didn't dream it up. Wasn't hers. The Blue-Green Alliance has been talking about a Green New Deal for probably about 13 years now. This isn't new. And they've been talking about how to transition so that, look, if you're still mining coal, there's a way to use that in a much better way. We need pipe fitters. We need steel workers. We need all of these people who are doing these jobs that's going to move us in that direction. And you make those good union jobs, and you have them as a partner going forward instead of being the ones that bear the brunt of the pain and suffering. And for those who are going to be left behind, because ultimately all the coal miners are going to lose their jobs at some point.
Well, and you know what? So did all the whalers.
Exactly.
And all the buggy whip manufacturers.
The thing is, though, how do you take those folks? Let me not even talk about the coal miners. I'll talk about myself. How do you take a 55-year-old truck driver who's used to making $90,000 a year and say, we're automating truck driving, you're out of a job?
Right, because that's coming.
It's coming. We know it's coming, so what's the transition? And I think it's actually a good thing. I don't think it's a horrible thing. I don't think it's the end of the world. I think it's progress. But how do we get there so that everyone who's affected by it doesn't end up homeless on the street? Because ultimately, that's what people are afraid of. You're taking my livelihood away, my ability to feed my children, to put a roof over their heads, to provide for my family and my future. That has to happen. A couple of months ago, I interviewed that Andrew Yang,
right,
the presidential candidate, who I like, doesn't stand a snowball's chance in hell, but he's got a good idea with the freedom dividend and a good idea on how to transition to this. And he's talking about a transfer tax. You tax these companies that are doing this at equal rates to the pay that they would have paid. And then you slowly do that away as those people would have been out of the industry. I think that's a reasonable transition so that people can one, go back to the dignity of some other type of employment, but still not lose all of their income. That makes sense to me. There's got to be a red circling somewhere instead of saying, hey, you're going to lose that $80,000 a year steelworker job. And I know this to be fact. Back in the 80s, I had friends who lost those big steelworker jobs only to go be retrained doing textile work, which we were outsourcing textile work.
Right. And then their job went away to...
And now their home health care aide's making $9 an hour.
And see, you're touching on something I was going to come back to as well, because I will talk about, you know, say... miners, being as, you know, Appalachian, all of that. One of the arguments that I have made, and I've actually made it to some folks in D.C., the shorthand term for it that I use is that we need an Appalachian Marshall Plan.
Absolutely.
You know, Germany was bombed flat in the Second World
War.
And West
Virginia has been raped.
And West Virginia has been bombed flat. Literally, flat. you know, 500 mountains. You know all the numbers.
Yeah.
2,000 miles of streams buried plus. And the guys, you know, and they did all that because the coal companies knew that it took less working people, whether they were union or non-union, and most of them are non-union.
Right.
It took less people. But nonetheless, those are people with jobs. And part of that Marshall Plan for Appalachia, and even going back to, you know, and let's just say it, Hillary could get her foot in her mouth faster than, you know, most people can put their shoes on.
Not nearly as fast as Joe Biden.
No. Well, the thing with Joe is, you know, he's going to get his foot in his mouth. You just don't know how he's going to get the other one in there with it. We kid. But the thing is, she actually had a plan that wasn't, let's put all the coal miners out of work. But she so inartfully said that at that forum in Ohio, as a West Virginian, I then saw that clip for 9 months, or however many months it was.
Right.
We're going to put all the co-workers out of work. you know, she didn't laugh, but you know that they thought that she was. So you mentioned the person who gets, you know, put out of the steel worker job, goes into being a textile worker, loses that, and is now a home health aide. What I said in the course of that conversation was, listen, a 55-year-old D9 dozer operator who's had his back vibrated into popcorn does not need to be taken out and retrained as a phlebotomist.
Right.
Okay?
And that, can't be. Look, most the reason they got into those jobs is because they couldn't become phlebotomists.
They need a check.
That's it.
And so from the standpoint of talking about Appalachia, you know, I believe in Davis Bacon money, for instance.
Right.
You know, if the government's going to spend money, it needs to be spent in such a way as it creates a living wage.
Absolutely.
And the living wage is paid according to the prevailing wage. So my notion is that, say, from 55 up, and that's my generation, so that means we have to work until we're 70 years old to get full Social Security. Because back when we were drinking beer and partying and not paying attention, the Republicans, in conjunction with some Democrats, screwed us to the wall. And so there's no retiring at 65 for us. 70, whatever. That guy needs a check.
Absolutely. And his family needs health insurance.
Right.
And absolutely.
Yeah. And so he needs a check commensurate with what he would have been earning. Now, if you're 55 and below and able-bodied, West Virginia and Central Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, Western Virginia, all that, you know where. None of those mountaintop removal sites have ever been reclaimed within the meaning of the law, only 3%. So you federalize the reclamation of all those surface mine sites, and you execute a project labor agreement with, say, the steel workers and the mine workers and of the other relevant unions. And even if it's non-union, which I would prefer it not be, it's still Davis-Bacon work. You charge a tax on every lump of coal that comes out of anywhere, and you fix Appalachia. You reclaim it really seriously, scientifically, and you've got work for three generations.
Right.
Because that's how long it's going to take.
No, and that is an excellent idea.
Because
there's so much we need to have done.
Right. And I think it's transferable to Fraxylvania. You know, do you have any idea how long the people of your state are going to have to work to have, you know, to remedy the damage and the harm that's been done? And West Virginia, and, you know, mercifully New York, no, but it's not the work of a week and a half.
Yeah, well, the fracking stuff they've kept so far in the non-populated areas where nobody sees it yet.
Yeah.
But the shock was my neighborhood, where they ran a pipeline right through, like thieves in the night. One day they showed up, and I'm usually on top of stuff. There's a pipeline going, and I'm going, when were the hearings on this? When were the public comments supposed to happen? All like thieves in the night.
And I mean, there's been an element of Pennsylvania state government that kind of wanted it that way, hasn't there?
Oh yeah,
yeah.
The frack people, they own the General Assembly. And look, our governor, who is probably one of the most progressive governors in the country, and who I call a friend, he's a frack guy too. I mean, because it's the revenue that he needs to get education money.
Yeah, sure. And, well, the problem is, you know, the mono economy giveth, the mono economy taketh away. Look at Oklahoma, for instance.
Yeah.
But that's it's hard to explain to a politician when they're cashing the checks. Well, Rick, I really appreciate you taking time here.
We should do this more often.
We should, and I don't mean just once an afternoon in Philadelphia. We really should. I should have you on my program because, I mean, you know that I'm as pro-labor as any human being can be. But there are questions out there that have to be answered that only labor can answer.
And they're uncomfortable. Yeah. And labor's got some problems ahead.
Yeah. And
which is why when I interviewed Sarah Nelson, the head of the American Flight Attendants Union, who, you know, the New York Times and The Guardian has said should be the next AFL-CIO president, I wholeheartedly agree because we need someone with the vision and the leadership and the giant set of stones that it's going to take to right this ship. And I think she's the right person.
Well, I need to learn a lot more about. I know who she is. I need to learn a lot more about her. I saw her speak in West Virginia back when Rich Ojeda was running for Congress. She seems to have that militant spirit, and there's going to have to.
She's
be
a hellraiser.
Yeah, and that's needed, and the more that you know. Labor is the mother church. You know, just as the Grand Ole Opry is the mother church of country music, labor is the mother church of progressivism.
Absolutely.
And we need some sort of a reformation because you know maybe the mother church is a little too Avignon right now for some people's likings, and maybe a little hidebound, maybe a little bit lost in the past.
Or maybe just people who are just holding on till.
Yeah.
Just need a couple more years.
Yeah, got a little. Got
and
a little,
someone else's problem.
Got a little Louis XIV going for him. Après moi, le déluge. You know, after me. Yeah.
Yeah.
The flood.
No, and they're all problems that I truly believe that we as working people can solve. As someone who believes in the democratic process of the unions, it's ultimately our responsibility to put people in those positions who are going to lead us in the right direction.
And if
I can, you know,
yeah,
the
no,
labor
please.
Movement just lost one of those true visionary labor leaders, someone who I called a good friend, Larry Hanley, who was the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union.
Yes.
One of the people who got it. He was one of the most progressive leaders in this country, and it's a huge loss for labor and for all of the issues that we've been talking about. Because he truly understood the importance of labor in all of those fights.
And he passed away
May 7th.
Yeah, I thought it was. I saw his obituary, and I knew it was not going to be good. We can't afford to lose any more good ones than we already do, yeah. Even to attrition. By the way, just let folks know, Rick, when, how, where, get the show.
TheRickSmithShow.com. Follow me on Twitter at RickSmithShow. We do our live program 9 to 11 p.m. weeknights. The Free Speech TV program Saturdays 7 p.m. on Free Speech. Check your local cable listings or just freespeech.org. Lots of places to get us podcasts. You know, wherever you get your Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, all of those.
You're all of those places. Rick Smith, I'm proud to call you a friend. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Bob. Good stuff.
I mean, it's not like he's actually going here. He's still sitting here, but... I'm going to wrap things up so that I can get everything uploaded and broken down and all of that. I've spent part of the time today running around the exhibit hall and trying to invite folks over to do interviews tomorrow. We'll be going at it all day tomorrow. And then with any luck at all, we may do a Friday on the Front Porch broadcast. Until then, shutting down. And until then... Ride through another day in Trump America, and try to keep it out of the ditches. Okay. And thanks again to everybody who made it possible for me to be here. We'll talk again tomorrow, Friday, the 12th of July. Thanks to all of you who keep the program going. Thanks to all of our subscribers, our contributors. Thank you to all of you who take part in the program in whatever means that you do so. Thank you. To our all-volunteer staff, thank you to Sparky and Steve in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, head on.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. 20 years at the forefront of the struggle for environmental justice and human rights in Appalachia. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.